Well, I want to make actually two confessions before I get started. Number one is, I just thought that was a good reminder for me as I delved into this portion and thought about these vestments, these things that the priests wear, their garments, these things that holy doesn't mean that this is some kind of mystical thing or that there's some kind of special power in these garments. It simply means that they're set apart. They're set apart for something different, for something holy, as is the person who's wearing them. He has, as he steps into those garments, he steps into the tabernacle to do these daily sacrifices or yearly sacrifices or blessings or different things. He's stepping in to do something holy, to do something set apart for God. So that was kind of the reminder that was good for me this week as I started in looking at these things. Okay, so let's get into our portion. Exodus chapter 27, verse 20 through chapter 30, verse 10. Just kind of a short portion, just three chapters basically here. And a quick little outline for what we're looking at this week. In chapter 27, as we start off, we're looking at the oil and the menorah. Chapter 28, the establishment of the priests, their clothing. And then in chapter 29, the inauguration of the priests and the inauguration of the altar and the establishment of daily offerings. And then as we round out into the first part of chapter 30, we get into the altar of incense. So we are closing in on the end of all of the things for the tabernacle. There's one item left in the tabernacle that won't be covered after this week. Anybody know what it is? One item. Yes, the laver. That's the only thing that'll be covered next week. But everything else we covered between last week and this week with the tabernacle. Okay, so we start off here in our portion. It says in 27, verse 20, "You shall command the people of Israel that they bring to you pure beaten olive oil for the light, that a lamp may regularly be set up to burn in the tent of meeting, outside the veil that is before the testimony. Aaron and his sons shall tend it from evening to morning before the Lord. And it shall be a statute forever to be observed throughout their generations by the people of Israel." Okay, so we've talked about the menorah. We talked about it last week, this branched candlestick, so to speak, that sits in the holy place in the tabernacle. And that the menorah represents, what does the menorah represent? Anybody remember, what does it represent in the tabernacle? What does it bring to the holy place? It brings light, right? Without the menorah, we wouldn't have light in there. So it brings light, and what does light represent? God. I had two passages that came to mind to me as I was looking at this of what light represents. The first is in Psalm 119. Anybody know what it is? "Your word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." So in some ways the menorah represents the word. It represents Torah. It represents a light for us, for our path, a light to our path, to our feet. And the second one from the New Testament in John, "And Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world." Okay, so these were just the two. I'm sure we could go into more, but these were the two that came up to me, that the light represents the Torah. It represents Yeshua. And those things represent truth, right? So the light represents truth, right? When we're in the darkness, we can't see truth. We can't see where we're going. We can't see what we're doing. But when we come into the light, we can see truth, and we can see what's going on. It's interesting here. We remember our story, right? We've come through the Exodus. We've come out of Egypt. the Israelite people are moving through the wilderness. And what's guiding the people as they're moving? There is a pillar of fire or light that is guiding them at night. And then there is a cloud that's also guiding them through the day. So up until this point, up until the building of the tabernacle, we see the people of Israel being guided by light. And there's a story in the Midrash Rabbah, and it describes this journey and this part of the journey this way. It says that the people's relationship, our relationship, is likened to a seeing man and a blind man who are walking together along the way. And the seeing man says to the blind man, let me take your hand and lead you on the way. Let me lead you to the place that we are going. But when they get home, when they get to the house, the seeing man says to the blind man, would you go in and light the light in the house for me so that I too may see? And the Midrash Rabbah likens us to our relationship here, that God led his people through the wilderness, through the desert, as their light. But yet now, as he brings them to the tabernacle, he says, okay, it's your turn. It's your, now you can take the light, you can kindle the light, and you can bring the light. So he gives us a chance to take some ownership, to take a part of what's going on here. And it's important when we look at the oil, this pure oil, this pure beaten oil, which is actually a process by which you make it, that makes it more pure, that we realize how specific God is in what he's asking here and what that means for us. I mean, think about this, right? It's God doesn't need us to kindle the lights of the menorah or a priest to kindle the lights of the menorah, right? That's the miracle of Hanukkah that we celebrate, right? The lights were kindled in this oil that was to last for a day, lasts for 8 days. Like, God clearly displays his power, and he's like, I don't need you to do this. But yet he asks us to kindle that light, or in this case, he asks the high priest to kindle this light, or the priest to kindle these lights daily in the menorah. And I think it's worth noting here that we should be careful that where and when God asks us to let him help us, or to us to help him, that we make sure and do what he's asking us to do. I think we can often get this confused, especially when we're taking on this responsibility. So we had this discussion at home. We were talking through the Torah portion at home, and we got to this section, and I'm talking about it with my kids, and I said, if I tell you guys, hey, Mom and I are going to run out and do this thing. While we're gone, I want you to sweep the floor. And I come home, and you didn't sweep the floor, but you mopped the floor. Did you obey me? Well, immediately my 11-year-old said, absolutely. Not only that, we did more than you asked us to do. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, we mopped the floor. My wife chimed in and said, Jack, do you remember how much of a mess it is when you mop the floor without sweeping the floor? And he said, I do. And I said, so did you guys obey me? And he said, no. And I said, well, your first answer was right. In your heart, you had obeyed me. You had, in your heart, said, not only am I going to do what Dad asked me to do, I'm going to go above and beyond. I'm going to mop the floor, too. But in the reality, in the truth, you hadn't obeyed me. You had skipped a step and done something different. And I think, at least I see in my life, where I can do this with the Lord. The Lord can give some very basic or sometimes very specific instructions. And I can say, I've got that. I'm going to go do this instead because it's better. But imagine the pandemonium that would have broken loose in the tabernacle in this very early stages of the Israelite nation had the specific instructions of God not been followed. with these people. So I think it's very telling for us that we are sure to follow his instructions well and listen well. And the way that we listen well, of course, is through submerging ourselves in the truth and taking time to study the truth, right? This menorah representing light representing truth, right? It's through the kindling of this in our lives, through the studying of Torah, through the studying in these things that we bring light into our life, that we bring truth into our light. And remember, I think last week Grant talked about as we go into the holy place, as we go into the tabernacle figuratively here, we're not just learning about God, but we're learning about ourselves. And we're learning who we are. And the more that we study the word and the more that we understand truth, the more that we learn who we are. And I think this is also a picture here with the menorah. Right? This inner part, this holy place in the tabernacle, the whole inside of it is gold. Right? A reflective, a bright, a brilliant surface. But worthless until we light the light of truth in there to reflect and for us to be able to see ourselves and to be able to see the truth that is in there. So I think that that's a very, especially as we look at the priests moving into the holy place and moving into this area and in their priestly vestments and their garments, and we think of them coming in there and needing this light to be able to see in this place. So as we move into Exodus 28, we begin to see the establishment of the priests. And it's interesting, here we are establishing this priestly class, these priestly people, and the first instruction that we're given is about what they wear, about how they dress themselves. I mean, there's any number of things that we could have, that Adam and I could have picked to talk about. You know, hey, this is what their daily schedule should be. Hey, this is how I want them to, you know, interact with people or any of these things. But the first thing that we jump to is their clothing. It says, "Then bring near to you Aaron and your brother and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, and you shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother. For dignity and splendor, you shall speak to all the skillful who I have filled with the spirit of skill, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him for my priesthood. These are the garments that they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checkered work, a turban, and a sash. They shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his son to serve me as priests." Okay, so the priest actually has 8 garments. 6 are listed here. What 2 garments are missing in this list, right as we start into here? There's 2 garments missing. Pardon? The turban is in there. It's the, but you're close. Yeah. What goes on the turban? What goes on the front of the turban? It's made of all gold. Yes, the plate that says Kadosh Adonai, the holy to the Lord, the head plate that goes on the front of the turban. So that's missing. There's one other thing that's missing. One other article that's missing. We're not going to see it until verse 42 at the very end. The priest's underwear. Yes, the undergarment. Okay. The sash is in here. The sash would have been worn by the regular priests, and then the high priest, when he donned his full apparel, the ephod had a belt in that was interwoven into it that worked as the sash for the high priest. So both of those are in there. So there's 2 pieces missing in this initial list here. One of those pieces is the head plate, And the other piece is the turban, or I'm sorry, the undershorts. So here is the head plate. I wonder how I get rid of that. There we go. This whole idea of the iPad, I'm supposed to be young and tech savvy, but I had to have Grant show me how to do this. So we see the head plate up at the top, and then also noted here is the undershort. So there's 8 pieces total here that make up the priestly garments. The turban, which we see up at the top, and on the head, and of course across the front of the turban is the head plate. The fringed tunic. Now, if you look at the picture here, it would seem, and I guess there's some debate between the sages over what's the tunic and what's the robe. So in the picture, you'll see the robe is pointing to the white thing. That is what I'm calling actually the tunic, which is the checker-plated, or the checker-pleated sort of woven, or box-knit, we call it, garment that goes against the body. And then I'm calling the robe what's called the tunic in this picture, or the outer part that's blue. But apparently those are, some people call them one and some people call them the other, and it can go either way. So we've got the turban, the tunic, the sash, which is again only worn by the regular priests, and then the undershorts, which we don't see here, but we will be talking about those here momentarily. That was kind of what a normal, the normal priest, every priest would have worn. And then the high priest would have worn the other 4 items that are on here. Right? It says in verse 40, for Aaron's sons, you shall make coats and sashes and caps. You shall make them for dignity and for splendor. And then we have these other 4 items that are for the high priest. Right? The head plate, this is made of all gold. It is inscribed with holy to the Lord on it. The robe, or in this case, in the picture, the tunic here, it is a turquoise wool. It's one piece, doubled over at the neck for reinforcement. On the bottom of it, around the bottom hem, are pomegranates and bells. Not actual, I have to confess, I thought they were actual pomegranates until this week when I was researching, and I'm like, oh, they're not actual, that makes a lot more sense, right? Like, you'd have to replace those every so often. One of the sources I read said that there's 72 of each of them around that bottom hinge, or fringe or hem of the robe at the bottom, and we can see them down here at the bottom of the tunic here. Okay, so we've got those. This is an outer garment. It's sleeveless on the sides, goes from the neck all the way to the ground. I would have to say that it must be more of a decorative function, because it's not covering, there's already a robe or tunic that's covering the body that this is going on top of. The ephod goes on top of that. That's what we see here with the multicolors. And this is interesting because it goes up from the shoulders, down the back, around the waist, and down. So it covers all of the priest except for this part here. Except for really from the neck to the waist. It's covering the majority of the rest of him. And this is also multicolor. It's gold, blue, purple, crimson yarns, finely twisted, worked into designs, all of these things, and woven together as one piece. It's also made to receive the breastplate up in the top, up here, and then also at the waist. There are 2 stones that go onto the ephod up here with the 6 tribes' names on one and 6 tribes on the others up on the shoulders. And again, I think it's significant that it covers the majority of the body except for what might be the most vital and vulnerable place in the body here. The ancient Jewish writings say that the ephod is a symbol of the nation's prosperity, and in a manner of looking at this on the priest's body, I could see that where it covers not the vital parts but the rest of the body, and would say, oh, the nation can be prosperous, they will have good harvest, there will be economic goodness, but it's this part covered by the breastplate here that is, you know, that's covering the most vital part. And the breastplate is seen as the thing of judgment or appeal to God. It's the same material as the ephod. Add that we are putting 12 precious stones into this. Now, I'm not sure what the 12 precious stones are. Apparently, the original Hebrew here is the way that's written, it's almost impossible to translate and say exactly what each stone would have been material-wise. But there's the 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel on here, set into a gold setting on the breastplate. The breastplate itself is actually, it looks square here, but it's actually double the length that it is the width, just like the tabernacle. But that bottom half of it is folded up behind to form a pocket in the breastplate, and it's into that pocket that the Urim and the Thummim are placed. And the Urim and Thummim, which we'll talk about here, are the were used to help make decisions, in at least early on in the nation of Israel. So they're stuck into this pocket behind, which is also why the breastplate is seen as the place of judgment. Again, it covers the breast of the priest, holds the 12 tribes, attaches in. It's significant in, at least in these early years of the nation, in providing insight from the Lord. Now, it seems that the Urim and the Thummim, these two stones that were used to somehow get judgments from the Lord, were later lost. And actually, some say this was replaced with prophecy as the prophets came about in the nation of Israel. They began to, you know, speak the word of the Lord. They weren't dependent on these to get answers from the Lord. Prager, in his book, suggests that these stones are sort of an evolutionary way of transforming the people of Israel into the monotheistic, God-fearing people that he wants. And what he means by that is that divination and using, looking for signs from gods was a fairly typical way in the ancient world of people interacting with their gods. And so, in a way, God was saying, I'm going to allow this right now, because I ultimately want to wean you into a different relationship with me. And so that was their purpose early on, was sort of a bridge to bring the people from where they were to where God wanted them to be. So you can take that for what it's worth. That's his thoughts. I really recommend actually reading the book and hearing him speak about this throughout the book of Exodus. And it's fascinating to see, you know, that connection there. But that's the breastplate. So we have all of these pieces of the high priest's garments, except for the head plate and the undershorts. These two things are left, I think, intentionally out of this first list of six. And later on, as we go through, we've discussed the building, the making of all of these things. It goes on in verse 36 to say, "And you shall make a plate of pure gold and engrave on it like the engraving of a signet, holy to the Lord." And then in verse 28:42, as we're kind of wrapping up this whole clothing vestment section, it says, "You shall make for them linen undergarments to cover their naked flesh. They shall reach from the hips to the thighs." So two things are left off of this list, and they seem to be almost complete opposites of one another. The first is exposed for all to see, and it declares the set apartness of the one wearing it. The other is kept secret. And it's keep secret a part of the body that is set apart for no one to see or to not be seen. So there's these two things left out, and they both are very different, yet both seem to be have this commonality. And I think that one lesson that jumps out to me right away is we can too easily in our lives expose what is meant to be kept secret and keep secret what is meant to be exposed. In other words, there's these two things here. One of them, we should be declaring, we should let people know we are holy to the Lord. The other is not to be exposed. Like last week when Grant spoke about what happens in the holies is between us and God. But what happens in the outer court is between us and others. There is a part, there are things that are for us. And there are things that are for others. And we need to make sure that we expose what we need to and keep secret what we don't. The other that jumps out to me is that if we want to wear holy to Hashem or holy to the Lord, if we want to be holy, then we need to control our drives, our passions as individuals. Specifically with the head plate and the undershorts, specifically with this is our sex drive. Is one of those things. The scriptures are replete with warnings about sexual sins, about falling into sexual immorality. And this, I think, is another great reminder that holiness begins in a whole other place. As we seek holiness, we need to go there. And I believe that our sensitivity to this, to sexual misconduct, to these things, can tie all the way back into these vestments, into these robes, into the clothes that we're wearing, and into dignity. In one of the translations, it says that these vestments are for dignity and adornment. Others say glory and beauty. Others say glory and splendor. But this idea of dignity, this idea that our clothing, that how we present ourselves is important. Dignity isn't just about our clothing. It's also about a mindset that we have. And I think that the actual word, the Hebrew word kabod, is what is used here. And it's translated dignity in one place and glory in another. And I think it's fitting that both of those words are used for kabod. Incidentally, kabod's found 14 times in the book of Exodus. It's only found 7 times outside of Exodus in the rest of the Torah. So it's found twice the amount in Exodus that it is in any of the rest of the Torah, which I think is really significant. Primarily, it's found in Moses coming to Pharaoh and asking for Pharaoh to let the people go. And God continuing to say, I'm going to do this to show my glory. So this idea of glory and dignity, I think go hand in hand. I think when we see people who live in dignity and who present themselves in dignity, we see a glory about them that's different than the rest of the people that we meet. When we see people who can't seem to grasp dignity, they're throwing themselves out there in very undignified ways, or they're dressing very undignified. We don't sense there's no glory about that. There's a way that they're putting the flesh forward and fleshly things forward to elicit a response, or to gain popularity, or to try to get their way or whatever. And so I think these two things are very tied together, and that as we grasp dignity in our lives, we also can be living in the glory that is what God intends for us to live in. in these words, glory and splendor, or dignity and adornment, that kabod was the first Hebrew word that meant glory. The second word in there for these garments for glory and splendor, splendor is the word tifarah, is the Hebrew word that's there. And tifarah is only used twice in the Torah, both here in chapter 28 of Exodus, in referring to the priestly garments. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I talked to a Hebrew scholar this week, and he told me that tifarah is it's a word that is now it's escaping me, but you know how when it symmetry. That's it, I got it. Symmetry. It's a word for symmetry or beauty that we've talked about this before at BT, that a lot of beauty is symmetry from one side to the other. And I think in these garments, when Adonai is giving these instructions for the garments, he is using something familiar, kabod, his glory, and he's saying these garments are for glory, they're for dignity, but he's bringing in this new idea, which it's not really a new idea, but maybe in this context, of beauty, of aesthetics, that, hey, there's another part of this, the splendor, the beauty, the tifarah, the symmetry of these garments is also important. So, these garments, right? Like, why are we spending so much time? Why of all the things to talk about with the priests are the garments important, the clothing important? I mean, of everything that we could talk about, this seems to really jump out at the Lord. And as I was reading this and studying, it seemed like clothing as a whole is important to the Lord. Right? We can go all the way back to the beginning of the Torah, beginning of scriptures in Genesis. In Genesis 3:21, remember Adam and Eve, they sin, they feel ashamed. Adam goes and sews together this fig leaf garment, which probably was pretty cool the first day you wore it, but by the third or fourth day it might have been a little more revealing. And Adonai's like, that's not good enough. I want you to have a better garment, a different garment. And again, the question raised here, like, you're about to kick Adam and Eve out of the garden, this perfect place where they have all these things, this great stuff, and your gift to them is clothing. That wouldn't have been the gift I would have picked. Maybe like a hoe or a plow or some seeds or something that would help me eat. Right? I mean, that would have been my pick because I like to eat. But yet God's pick is clothing. Of all the things that I can give you, mankind, as I remove you from the garden and send you into the world, I am going to make clothing for you, a covering for you, to bring dignity to you, to bring glory to you. In fact, and this would probably be a great study all by itself, Isaiah 6:1, it says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Apparently, Adonai wears clothes too. Or at least in this case, we see that the train of his robe. So it's not just something that is distinct, like, oh, mankind, clothes are good for him. But that's it. There seems to be a part of Adonai and his character and who he is that clothing is good for. Incidentally, clothing is one of the big things that separates us from the animal world, right? Animals don't wear clothes, but we do. I mean, there are other things in most of our cases, but this is one of them. Well, as we jump into the New Testament, and I'm skipping a bunch of different parts of clothing here, just catching some highlights. We get to the parable of the wedding feast in Matthew 22:11. But when the king came to look in at the guests, he saw that there was a man who had no wedding garment. And he said to him, "Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding garment?" And he was speechless. Again, not just clothing or garments are important, but a specific garment in this case, the specific garment for this wedding. And if we remember that in this parable, the guests at the wedding are not only the guests, but they represent also the bride of Christ. So the guest or the bride who has come into this wedding feast is not clothed in proper attire to be in the wedding feast. And what's the proper attire? Well, let's look at Revelation 19:8, the marriage supper of the Lamb. "Let us rejoice and exult and give glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. It was granted her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure." So the wedding guest, the bride of Christ, is to be clothed in fine linen. The high priests are to be clothed in fine linen, and to be clothed in finely made articles of clothing. And it says that, if we go back here, it says that "you shall speak to the skillful, who I have filled with a spirit of skill, that they may make Aaron's garments," that they are to be in skillfully made clothing. So what is their clothing? In Psalms it says, "Let your priests be clothed with righteousness." The priestly garments in a way represent not only holiness but righteousness. They're clothed in garments made by skillful craftsmen, full of skill, that represent righteousness. So what is a skillful craftsman? I work in the trades, and I have a lot of guys that work for me that it's like, well, they do an okay job, and I have a few guys that work for me that it's like, that guy is a craftsman. I want to do work the way that he does work. I want to approach work the way that he approaches it. I want my end product to look the way his end product does. And I didn't think I was really competitive. It turns out I'm super competitive. Like, I get so mad when a guy that works for me is like way better than me. And I'm like, "Oh, I can't believe you're faster than me. I can't believe this looks better than me." But I've learned to acknowledge, like, this guy's really good at what he does. He's a really good craftsman. A craftsman is somebody who can take what has either been put in their mind, or in my case is on a blueprint or a drawing, and can turn it from a drawing to a reality. That's a skillful craftsman, right? They possess this ability to use their hands to recreate what was up here or what was written down or given to them into something beautiful, into a work of art, into a building, into something functional. Okay, so these craftsmen who are building or weaving or making these priestly garments, right? They're skillful. They are given instructions from God. God's given instructions. This is what I want it to be. And they take those instructions and turn them into a beautiful work of art, into clothing that these priests wear. So I left out here the very end of this verse in Revelation 19:8, "clothe herself in fine linen, bright and pure." Does anybody know what the end of that is? The end of Revelation, "for the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints." The righteousness, the linen is the righteous deeds of the saints. So the bride of Christ is to clothe herself in a fine linen that's the righteous deeds that she has completed throughout her life, woven together to present back to Yeshua. Right? We're responsible to make, in a sense, our wedding dress to come before Yeshua. How do we do that? How do we become a skillful worker, a skillful craftsman? And I believe that we become a skillful craftsman through truth. Through, we go back here to the holies, through the kindling of the menorah, through the Torah in our lives. It's interesting that in Hebrew, the word for belt of truth, for craftsman, and for, I think, skillful, to think craftsman and belt are all the same word. So these things are linked together. And that we are to use truth to become craftsmen, to gird ourselves up, to clothe or robe ourselves in righteousness. And that, you know, brings to mind, of course, Ephesians 6:14 with the armor of God, sort of the counterpart here to the priestly garments. The priestly garments given to the priests as they approach God and in his presence. The armor of God given to us as we stand against the attack of the enemy. And in the armor of God, stand therefore having fastened the belt of truth around you. Tightly fastening the belt of truth. So bringing truth around us. If we jump ahead into chapter 30, the end of our portion here, there is, I think, another piece of this that comes together with truth. And that is the last piece or article that goes into the holies, the altar of incense. It says, "You shall make an altar on which to burn incense. You shall make it of acacia wood. A cubit shall be its length, and a cubit its breadth. It shall be square, and two cubits shall be its height. Its horns shall be of one piece with it. You shall overlay it with pure gold, its top and around its sides and its horns. And you shall make a molding of gold around it, and you shall make two gold rings for it. Under its molding, on two opposite sides of it, you shall make them. And they shall be holders for poles with which to carry it. You shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. And you shall put it in front of the veil that is above the ark of the testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony, where I will meet with you. And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps at twilight, he shall burn it. A regular incense offering before the Lord throughout your generations. You shall not offer unauthorized incense on it, or a burnt offering, or a grain offering. And you shall not pour a drink offering on it. Aaron shall make atonement on its horns once a year. With the blood of the sin offering of atonement, he shall make atonement for it once in a year throughout your generations. It is most holy to the Lord." So we see this last piece that goes into the holies, the altar of incense made of acacia wood, covered with pure gold, and it's going to go inside of the holies with the menorah and the table of showbread, actually located somewhere kind of in the center of the room. We were discussing that last night, and my son was like, "Oh, right, it goes right in front of the veil." And I said, "That's what I thought too when I was reading this." And then I read some other people who said, "No, it goes in the very center of the room." I don't know where it goes. It goes in there somewhere with this other stuff. It's a square altar, two cubits high, and it's specifically for burning incense. Specifically, just the incense that Adonai has instructed to be mixed and to be put onto it, not to burn anything else on this. The altar of incense was located inside. So keep in mind, we're not in the Holy of Holies, but we're in this holy place. We're not in the common place. We're not in the outer court. We're in this place of spiritual intimacy with God and in the context of this inner court area. And so what this altar of incense reveals, what this altar of incense does, is something that can be a very personal and intimate relationship between us and God. Right? And the altar of incense is likened to, it is sort of representative of our prayers. And so as the altar of incense offers up this pleasing aroma, so too our prayers can be offered up as a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But notice the altar of incense is intertwined with what other piece in the holies? It was just in that section. There's another piece that's in there. You got a 50-50 chance because there's only two other things in there. The menorah. Right? The altar of incense is, it's intertwined with the menorah because it says when the priest goes in to either clean the menorah in the morning or kindle the lights of the menorah in the evening, he's also to light up the incense altar or to freshen it up or whatever it is you do with the incense stuff. Okay? So what did the menorah represent? Light, truth, Torah, life of Yeshua. What does the incense altar represent? Prayer. Our prayers and our study of Torah are to be intertwined. I mentioned at home last night to my kids, I said, do you think this could be what it means to pray in Yeshua's name? And my oldest said, are you asking my opinion, or is this one of those times where you're telling me? And I go, well, no, I'm asking your opinion. And he goes, oh, I don't know. So I'm telling him. Okay, so there is a way. There's two parts to this, I think. First is what our prayers and what they are they in line with what Torah teaches? Are they in line with what Yeshua models? Are we praying in that vein? But the second, and I would have to admit this is not a strong point for me, is the word prompting us to pray? And are we acting on that? When we light the light of the Torah in our lives, of the Word in our lives, and Adonai brings something and says, this is a big deal. Do we take the time to pray about that and for that to affect our relationship with Him and our interaction with Him? So there's two parts, I think, in that are intertwined. And I'll say it again because I think it's important, even if my son doesn't. I really do think this reveals a lot of what it means to pray in Yeshua's name. To have these two elements that are working together, both the light, the truth, and the prayer together, intertwined, you know, representing in who we are and what we are doing. But again, this is all happening in the context of this inner court, this holy place, this intimate relationship with the Lord. And lest we think that there's a struggle here, and I many times, you know, will find myself when I get into a struggle being confused and doing the wrong thing, and that's part of what we do to learn. But if we notice here in this inner court, we have the golden incense altar. Here they've got it very close to the veil, and also the table of showbread and the menorah. And there we've got a little priest in there as well. But lest we think that the things that happen here in this inner part not be a part of the rest of our life, I wanted to read this quote by a rabbi. It says, "One who spends most of his time in the tabernacle of Torah study must be careful to be even more holy when he is outside among the world, So strongly influenced must he be by his Torah study that his behavior should impress others as being so much holier as to be worthy of emulation. While our relationship can be very private and very intimate and very between us, our spouse, the Lord, or us and the Lord, it should not be so divorced from our life that it is not evident. While the very specifics of the inner workings of how we relate to the Lord or what happens between us and the Lord may not be public, the result is public. The result of what happens is public. And so we need to be very careful that we don't neglect the one or not neglect or are so involved in one that we don't feel that it has a part of who we are as the other. Okay, well, everybody's been super quiet, which is okay. Don't ask me any questions, but feel free to make comments. I mean, you can ask me questions. I probably won't know the answer, but that's okay. But, all right, well, let me close in prayer, and then we'll invite Tim up to give us the blessing. Father God, we are grateful for the instruction that you leave to us, Lord, the specifics, the details, every piece of it that we can delve into and discover more of you and more of us in. Lord, give us strength to study your word, to let it permeate our souls and our bodies and our minds, and to live that out to a world that will want to emulate us and seek your presence in their lives as well. Lord, and we pray this in Yeshua's name. Amen.